This is another iRaw podcast.
The main premise when it comes to One Health is that the health and welfare of animals, humans, and the environment are interlinked.
Welcome back to Season 5, Episode 9 of the Animal Tone Podcast. You're here with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder. In this season, we've been speaking about animals and biosecurity. It's been a great season. We've learned a lot. Things have been quite busy this season. I know we came out strong with an episode a week, but very quickly realized heading towards the end of the year, as I'm polishing up and finishing my PhD, and as the end of year, busyness began, that kind of keeping up that schedule was no longer possible. So I'm sorry that we've kind of spaced things out a bit more, but we've made it. We're here with episode 9. And I'm delighted to be speaking to Nina Jamal in this episode about One Health. As you know, kind of throughout the season so far, I've been, One Health has come up, I think, from episode 1 throughout. So it's really great that we've got an episode that's completely dedicated to speaking about One Health. And Nina Jamal is a perfect person to be doing that with. So let me tell you a little bit about her. Nina Jamal is leading the Four Paws efforts on pandemics and animal welfare and campaign strategies. Before taking on that role, and since 2013, Nina led the international campaigns on farm animals and farm nutrition campaigns. Nina has also worked in the climate movement on international policy and campaigns, as well as the private sector and UNIDO. Her background is in environmental health sciences, public health, and international environmental policy. So the work Nina does is incredibly interesting. She contributes a lot to thinking about both international and national policies related to health, and she's done work directly related to thinking about animals and pandemics. If you haven't heard of Four Paws before, definitely go check out their website. Four Paws is doing a load of incredible work with tons of different animals. And Nina and I have a really interesting conversation, I think, that straddles a whole bunch of different levels. And in many ways, this episode complements very well the one before, where we spoke to Gladys. So whereas Gladys was speaking about community-led conservation, and we were speaking about some of the interventions that happen on the ground with communities directly in contact with specific animals, Nina and I are speaking at a much more kind of policy and high-end level about One Health, what kind of conversations and policies need to be in place in order for One Health to become a reality. And I think that together, these two episodes provide a really interesting backdrop for thinking about biosecurity and the ways in which biosecurity, humans, animals, health, disease are interconnected. And I think it's a perfect way to end this season's interviews. And remember, next episode, we're going to be doing the grad review. It's going to be an awesome conversation, as always, between myself and two graduate students, where we're going to be unpacking some of the tensions and opportunities and ideas that we've encountered in this season. So make sure you check in for the 10th episode. But for now, let's get to the conversation with Nina. Hi, Nina. Welcome to the Animal Tone Podcast.
Hi. Thank you so much, Claudia, for having me.
It's great to have you here, because throughout the season so far, I think in almost every single episode, the concept of One Health has come up. So I think it's important that we sit towards the end of the season now and focus on what is One Health and what are some of the challenges and opportunities with the concept. But before we get into that, let's learn a little bit about you first. So could you tell us a bit about you and some of the work you do?
Yes, of course. So I'm Nina. I work at Four Paws International. It's a global animal welfare organization. My background is in environmental health and sciences, public health, and environmental policy. And that linked very much to my current task, which is working on pandemics and preventing pandemics. Because when COVID-19 began, it became clear that the way we treat animals could have an impact on our lives in so many ways. And there is a need for us to improve animal welfare and our relationship with animals and the environment, because that also affects our health and well-being, which brings us to One Health.
One Health. So were you working on pandemics prior to COVID-19, or was that a product of COVID-19 happening?
No. So Four Paws worked actually on animal welfare, so tackling animal suffering. So we were working on solving the problems that can trigger spillover of pathogens from animals to humans. So we were tackling illegal wildlife trade. We were tackling live animal markets, ending factory farming, dog and cat meat trade, fur farming, all of these kinds of keeping systems and relationships with animals that are dysfunctional are triggers of pathogens spilling over from animals to humans. And this is our core expertise. And this is why we decided that it was important for us to engage in the international health debate, because the way we treat animals has an impact on our health.
Yeah, and certainly on their health as well. You said your background is environmental sciences. Was disease always an interest for you, or were animals always an interest for you?
Yes. So for me, the element that was of interest also through my studies, when I studied environmental health and sciences, we looked at farming, we looked at slaughter, looked at handling of animals, we looked at food quality, at diseases. We had our microbiology classes as well. So it was a type of interdisciplinary education. And I believe that that kind of interlinkage emerges more and more in all kinds of disciplines related to environmental health, in terms of animal welfare, human health. Any kind of degree that has to do with either of these ends up touching upon any of the others because they're so interlinked.
Yeah, I know. I've certainly found that with my, I mean, I'm looking at the history of animals, and you almost can't look at the history of animals without disease coming up at some point or another. So it definitely is interesting. So maybe we can dive straight into it then. Let's perhaps start with thinking about One Health itself. So people seem to be using it all over the show. I feel like maybe it's a really broad concept. So could you just start us off with a general understanding of what is One Health? What is the main premise?
So the main premise when it comes to One Health is that the health and welfare of animals, humans, and the environment are interlinked. We cannot view any of them in isolation. However, One Health has been an evolving concept. The first time that there was a realization that human and animal medicine cannot be divided was in the early 1980s, 1984, through the One Medicine approach. And then the process kept evolving. So many years later, there was a realization that we cannot just talk about humans and animals. We have to also talk about the environment, because the drivers of possible outbreaks, they are in nature, in the environment. So by 2004, environment was added, and the thinking about emergence of multiple zoonoses. So it was a time where several zoonotic outbreaks had emerged and were in the news. So it was difficult to ignore that environment is also a component that we need to add to the One Health concept. And the concept kept evolving. And depending on who the practitioners were that were working on it, there was a different type of focus. And we finally reached a very interesting point in time when it comes to One Health, which was last year, 2021. So in 2021, there was a new definition of One Health by the One Health High-Level Expert Panel. This panel is made up of 26 experts. They were selected out of hundreds of experts by four international institutions. So they were selected by the WHO, the World Organization for Animal Health, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and the United Nations Environmental Program. And they were tasked to look at the concept of One Health, update the definition. And the definition that they ended up agreeing on is, One Health is an integrated, unifying approach that aims to sustainably balance and optimize the health of people, animals, and ecosystems. And it recognizes that the health of humans, domestic and wild animals, plants, and the wider environment, including ecosystems, are closely interlinked and interdependent. And that is a historical moment in the history of One Health, because it will bring a lot of opportunities, and it is a chance to address all the gaps that have existed in previous definitions of One Health and interpretations of One Health.
One thing I really like is that there is a kind of splitting up to some extent of animals and nature, animals and environment. Because so often I think when we talk about looking after the environment, animals are kind of just caught up in that idea, and they're what animals need in particular, kind of an ecocentric view can sometimes neglect the fact that animals experience nature and that they also get sick and that they are agents as well. So I really appreciate that there's kind of this idea that there are these three different pillars. But a big concern I've kind of had with One Health since the beginning, and this was reiterated for me to some extent because I watched the intergovernmental negotiating body. I watched some of those proceedings because for folks who don't know, they're having big conversations right now at the World Health Organization about developing a pandemic treaty and about developing a pandemic instrument. And a lot of stakeholders and countries and member states are getting to say what they'd like this instrument to look like. And one of the phrases that came up time and again was One Health. It just was One Health, One Health, One Health. But no one was really specific about what it means. Like, what does it mean to talk about environmental health? What does it mean to talk about? It just seems too easy to talk about without actually thinking about what are we talking about? When we talk about environmental health, what does that mean? When we talk about animal health, what does that mean?
Yes. Yes. It's about what does it mean? Who is defining what it means and what it should mean? So over the past years, what One Health meant was we need to improve surveillance, or we recognize that the health of animals and the environment has an impact on humans. But what it should mean, and this is what I meant by this new One Health high-level expert panel definition of One Health can bring opportunities with it, is because in the new formulation, what the experts recognize and what the four international institutions support, so WHO, World Organization for Animal Health, FAO, and UNEP, what they recognize is that it's not just about how the health of the environment and animals affect humans. It's also about how our activities, how the way we treat animals has an impact on us as well. So the new component that was added in the new definition is we need to change the way that we're treating animals and the environment. We need a more ecocentric approach. We need to move away from the anthropocentric way in which we think about how we need to just lock the animals up. Let's do biosecurity, keep the pathogens away, and hope that nothing bad happens. So the new definition goes more into tackling the root causes of the problem. And this is something that is necessary. So in the negotiations on the pandemic instrument, so far, the concrete formulation of One Health now is the same as the One Health high-level expert panel definition. This was not the case before. In the former drafts of the working draft, or now the conceptual zero draft, former formulations were still anthropocentric, but in the latest conceptual zero draft, the One Health high-level expert panel definition is in the language. However, when we look at the operational elements, how does the intergovernmental negotiating body think we need to implement One Health? There we go back to the point of surveillance. Let's have surveillance systems that integrate One Health. So let's just monitor. Or yes, let's develop One Health, national One Health action plans on antimicrobial resistance. But it doesn't yet reflect this evolution. And this evolution is still new. So maybe there's hope that the way One Health gets implemented in the end in the pandemic instrument is an ecocentric approach rather than an anthropocentric one.
So if I understand you correctly, what it's kind of doing now is it's still being very reactive, like let's watch and see what's happening. And it's not yet, One Health offers us an opportunity to kind of completely reformulate and rethink how we interact with environments and how we interact with animals. But currently the kind of take up on it in the policy level is maybe a bit more cautious than that, and is maybe not going to the kind of root causes of what's creating, if we're speaking about pandemic prevention, what is creating the circumstances for pandemics in the first place. So maybe you could tell us, like, what are What are some of the big things that are causing pandemics? What, when we're talking about environmental health, what do we need to keep safe? And when we're talking about animal health, what do we need to keep safe?
So when we talk about what is driving pandemic, there are risks. So risky practices and hotspots and activities. So one of the main human activities that is bringing pathogens from the wild closer to humans and domesticated animals is deforestation, habitat loss. We are logging massive amounts of forests and healthy ecosystems, partly for urbanization, but partly because we're using all this land to feed and grow farm animals. So 70% of agricultural land on the planet is being used to keep and feed farm animals. Because we have increased our consumption of animal products massively over the past decades. And this is on the one hand inefficient, and on the other hand, very, very risky practice, because the buffer between the wild where pathogens exist naturally and humans, as well as domesticated animals, is becoming smaller and smaller. So that's one of the drivers. However, any kind of situation where we put a massive amount of animals in a stressful environment where they're likely to get sick, where they are bred in a way to grow as fast as possible, is conducive. It makes them more receptive to pathogens, to illnesses. It makes it more likely for these viruses to spread. So that's also another issue. So related, for example, to factory farming, also fur farming. If we think, for example, about the wildlife trade or live animal markets, what's happening there is also that we're bringing pathogens, which we as humans don't know yet. Our bodies do not know these viruses. Or if we think about wildlife markets or live animal markets, where we have different species of animals crammed in a very closed environment, some of them are being slaughtered. So we have all the blood, all the feces. So that kind of situation where we have all these animals from different species, as well as the sanitary conditions, are very conducive as well for pathogens to jump from one species to the next. In fur farms, we had a very worrying development at the beginning of the pandemic, where COVID-19 was jumping from humans to animals and then jumping back. So we saw massive culling of animals in fur farms at the beginning of the pandemic because of this. However, we have not yet seen a full phase out. We are waiting to see whether governments are going to end fur farming, because that was also a clear risk. So there are lots of situations in which we are driving pathogens to come into contact with humans. And the fact that we are putting animals in stressful conditions makes it an even riskier kind of situation.
Okay, so those speak to some of how humans are perhaps at risk of getting sick, right? So through intensive practices like agriculture and fur farming, but also loss of habitat, and that this is bringing humans and animals closer together and allowing for more opportunities for diseases to spread between us. But how then are animals also, so you said there that it's jumping from, you know, there are diseases out in nature out there that can possibly impact humans. But sometimes this kind of speaking makes me think that we've got this idea that humans and animals are separate from one another, that we live in a different world, that if we just look after nature out there, then humans in here will be okay. But surely it's, I mean, I'm guessing what you're saying here is that too many of us are coming to too close contact. But yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, are we not creating this idea that humans and nature are separate when we talk like this?
Yes, that is a good question. So humans live in contact with nature and animals. The risk emerges when the patterns change. So when we are in contact with species that we are not usually in contact with, if we think about indigenous communities that live in forests, that live in healthy ecosystems, they are not at risk of of pathogens spilling over. And it is possibly because they have found a healthy way of interacting with nature. It could, I don't know, so I'm not a virologist. I wouldn't be able to say for sure, but maybe the animals that they've come into contact with, maybe they develop a level of immunity that protects them. However, I mean, humans are in contact with nature and animals on daily basis, but it's animals that we're regularly in contact with, and where our bodies know the pathogens. I mean, if we think about influenza, we have established a certain level of immunity to certain strains of influenza with time.
So it's when things change, and things change too quickly for our bodies or animals' bodies to kind of adapt. So I understand that humans are at risk here of kind of these close contacts. What risks are they posed to animals? So these diseases move through animals' bodies too. Do they get sick, or is it just a matter of bacteria are jumping from animals to humans? What kind of diseases are animals facing?
Animals, so there are two kinds of situations. There are situations where certain viruses are carried by animals, and the animals are asymptomatic because their bodies have developed a certain level of immunity. And there are cases where the animals get sick. And in both cases, there could be a risk of the pathogens spilling over from these animals to humans. So, for example, in bats, there could be viruses that do not trigger any kind of symptoms because the animals' bodies know these pathogens. They have developed an immune response. There are other cases, for example, with highly pathogenic avian influenza, where the animals could also display symptoms, and it could also be dangerous for humans if by chance the strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza is one that can mutate to the extent that it could spill over to humans.
So prior to starting the interview, we were talking a little bit about One Health, and you know, and I've expressed my concerns, and I've read your reports just before the interview as well, and I know that Four Paws is advocating for a One Welfare approach versus a One Health approach. How is this different? What are you trying to show here?
Yes, indeed. So in 2020, Four Paws published a report in which we interviewed 29 experts from different disciplines from all over the world on pandemic prevention. And we looked at the concept of One Health versus the concept of One Welfare. And the reason why we were concerned about One Health was because the concept was still too anthropocentric. It did not consider what kind of measures we need to change or what kind of activities we need to change to improve animal welfare, to improve the state of the environment. And this is why we found the One Welfare definition to be more fitting, because it highlights not just health, not just the absence of disease, it highlights well-being, it highlights welfare. And this is a more holistic way of developing strategies. If we are saying we don't just want to make sure that these animals are free of disease, we want to make sure that they have positive experiences, that they are kept in systems where they're not just given medication so that they don't get sick and infect us, but rather where they're kept in conditions that fit their natural and behavioral needs, then we have more resilient animals. We have a better balance with nature. We have a more root cause driven strategy. So we don't just put a band-aid on the problem. We don't just isolate the animals, keep them far, and as long as they don't display symptoms, everything is fine. But rather, we go a step further and we think about what kind of activities do we need to change? What kind of improvements do we need to make so that the animals do not get sick in the first place? So it's a step further.
Could you give me an example?
So, for example, if we think about right now, we have keeping systems where broiler chickens are bred in a way that makes them grow as quickly as possible. So in a few weeks, you have, so between birth and slaughter, You only have a few weeks. And these animals, the fact that they're bred in a way to grow as quick as possible means that they have to eat protein. They have to eat feed that their intestines and stomach cannot properly process, which means they get sick and then they get antibiotics so that they survive basically until slaughter. So we have systems in which we're breeding and keeping animals in a way that is focused on performance. And through a one welfare kind of approach, we would look at the people caring for these animals. We would look at the animals and the way that they need to be bred and kept. And we look at the state of the environment. So a one welfare kind of system would be one where we have smallholder farmers working with locally appropriate, resilient, diverse breeds of broilers that are kept in an outdoor system where the feed that they are given fits their behavioral and natural needs. Maybe these animals would grow slower, but everybody benefits. So through a one welfare approach, everyone benefits: animals, the environment, and humans. And we now have a situation where the One Health High Level Extra Panel definition is trying to move closer to the one welfare thing.
But my concern with that, so you say everyone benefits, but obviously the chickens who are still caught up in that situation are not benefiting. So, you know, and I think that this is a common tension when talking about welfare policies, is to what extent is a welfare policy just kind of sustaining what are often quite abusive models for how animals are kept. So yes, there might be a move from broader factory farms and animal agriculture, which is certainly where you've got large populations of birds and animals being kept and diseases spread. Are we not just sustaining the very ideas that we're saying are wrong, or that are contributing to the spread of disease? And that is at its core the exploitation of animals.
That's an excellent point, Claudia. So one of the prerequisites of a system where we have animal welfare and we reduce the not disease risk is a system where we phase out factory farming. We cannot maintain our current practices. We need to tackle the root causes. The root causes are also the fact that we're using so much land to feed so many animals that are kept in systems that are horrendous and totally unacceptable. I mean, we're breeding animals in a way that makes them sick, then giving them antibiotics so that they survive until slaughter. So the future or the solution is a predominantly plant-based diet, which will mean more sustainable food systems, much less animals farmed and consumed, and a system where we don't have big companies profiting from keeping massive factory farms, but rather ensuring food security, enabling people's livelihoods while having much less animals farmed.
So you've brought up antibiotics a couple of times here, and I know that in discussions on the pandemic instrument, this has come up a lot, and I was quite surprised. I mean, I knew that antibiotics were being used because, as you say, the systems are broken and animals are sick and we kind of just feed them. But I had no idea that, you know, 80% of the antibiotics that are used in the world are going to these animals, and that there's now antimicrobial resistance that's killing just massive numbers of people. And I know several people in these kinds of negotiations were saying, the next pandemic is here. Like, it's here. People are dying with this. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about how antimicrobial resistance works and what that means in terms of talking about One Health, One Welfare, or biosecurity?
Yes. So when it comes to antimicrobial resistance, it's, as you said, 80% of antibiotics that are used on animals, which means that we have a situation where we are inappropriately using these antibiotics. The reason why we are using so much antibiotics on animals is because we are keeping them in conditions that make them sick. And we are breeding them in a situation to the extent that they get sick. So the easiest way to explain it is if we think again about broiler farms. These animals are supposed to grow in a few weeks' time. They cannot process these massive amounts of food, high protein food, that they are given so that they can grow as quickly as possible. So they end up getting antibiotics for intestinal problems. They end up getting antibiotics for bone or other health issues. So what we're doing is we are enabling the development of superbugs, because these antibiotics learn, the microbes that are combated with these antibiotics learn how to evade these antibiotics. So when people are sick and receive antibiotics, these antibiotics don't work anymore. So a big part of the problem is inappropriate use. Inappropriate use of antibiotics can be in factory farm systems. It can also, of course, be inappropriate use if people do not take the full dosage. So there are, of course, other parts of the problem. But the biggest part of the problem is the massive amount of antibiotics that we're using in factory farms.
What kind of antibiotics are we talking about? Are we speaking about, like, are we imagining a world here where penicillin is not going to work in future? Or, you know, because that has, I think we kind of have this idea that technology is always going to save us, you know. Technology is amazing, computers are doing awesome things, and that there's just new antibiotics being created all the time. So it doesn't matter which disease comes, there'll be a new medicine tomorrow. But I'm guessing that's not the case.
It's a very spot on remark that you just gave, because so FourPaws was at the World Health Summit in October 2022, and there was a session, there were a couple of sessions on antimicrobial resistance. And what they were talking about was trying to split between the types of antibiotics that we give animals and the types of antibiotics that we give humans. They talked about increasing funding to develop new kinds of antibiotics. And that was the main message. That was their main plan. So they weren't talking at all about whether we need to change the conditions in which we keep animals. That we need to keep animals in a way that does not make them sick so that we don't have to give them antibiotics in the first place. That was not part of the conversation. And if we look at One Health and AMR, so there are national action plans on antimicrobial resistance developed by several governments. And in none of these plans, we haven't found any plans that include measures to improve keeping conditions of animals. We haven't found plans in which governments talk about working with breeds of animals that do not grow so quickly. So high yield, high performance breeds. So those kinds of root causes are not part of the plan. And to tackle antimicrobial resistance, we go back to the need to reduce the amount of animal products that we consume. We cannot keep consuming the same amount of animals and solve the antimicrobial resistance problem. Because if we continue consuming this amount of animals, then we'll continue keeping them in factory farms. We'll continue breeding them in a way that is geared to high performance, growing as quickly as possible, so that we meet that high demand for animal products. So there is a huge gap at the moment when it comes to the strategies to tackle antimicrobial resistance.
Yeah, it's kind of startling. I spoke to Thomas Harting, who's a toxicologist, about, you know, animal testing and the development of new technologies. And just the amount it costs to produce one new drug is absolutely, so even if you start to have this kind of economic discussion, which somehow we always end up in this economic realm, it doesn't seem very economically feasible or clever either to just kind of put all of our hopes in the idea that there will be new drugs in future. And these economic tensions, I think, come to some of my other concerns with One Health. And I know right now it's the best idea we have. So I'm not trying to just, you know, beat it down. But so I look at the Sustainable Development Goals, for example. They've done amazing work over the past two decades that they've been used. They've really brought different issues to people's imaginations. People are talking. But sometimes I find it's easy to talk and not as easy to do. And on the other hand, while sustainable development has like these different pillars that we're all supposed to consider, everybody kind of knows that the most important pillar, the pillar that governments and industry are most concerned with, is economics. So even here, when we're speaking about human health and animal health, and, you know, are we still just always putting economics at the forefront? And based on what you've just said to me here, it sounds like that's still just it's the same ideas again. So how do we start to disrupt that is really hard.
Yes, I love that you're talking about economics and the drivers, because changing the system is largely an economic strategy. So what we need to see, and so there are conversations about a paradigm shift when it comes to economics. Within the WHO, there is a council called the Council on the Economics of Health for All. And what they're saying in that concept is we need to view health as an investment, not as a cost. We need to figure out what the outcome should be. And the outcome cannot be GDP. We cannot continue focusing on GDP as the one indicator of success of a government or a system. We need to develop other indicators. And these indicators are, or could be, the right to a healthy environment, access to clean water, but also better ways of keeping animals so that they don't get sick and they don't get us sick. So on the economics track, so when we talk about the economy of health for all, viewing health as an investment, not as a cost, this is also in line with the thinking on the economics of well-being. And this kind of concept is getting more traction. If governments develop policies in that way and say, we will evaluate the success of our sectors, not based on the extent to which they grow, but based on the extent to which they enable well-being, then national strategies would shift away from making sure we have profitable companies because GDP is the measure of success. It would move towards we need to have a healthy, prosperous society. And the prerequisite here is improving our relationship to animals and nature.
Yeah, I like that we're speaking at this kind of broader global level, because it brings some. So in my previous interview with Gladys, we were speaking about kind of community-led conservation, which is really important. You need that conversation happening at community organizations, particularly where you have kind of an interface between humans and particular wildlife populations. But at this global level, like I could imagine we create these different indicators where some societies are saying, oh, we're healthy for these and these reasons. But for that to be fair, we also need to be talking globally in terms of how many countries in the global north export some of the worst conditions, that some of the worst factories that they use to supply their societies. They export their own trash. They go into other communities and literally take the biodiversity from those communities to develop medicines to sell back to them, which I think is now increasingly called like biocolonialism. It's interesting that when you start to look at this global level, you realize that GDP at the national level can't be everything, but nor can just the national level, because otherwise you're going to have rich countries just sending their problems elsewhere.
Absolutely. So if we think about the drivers of zoonotic disease outbreaks, deforestation, logging, Europe and the US are importing soy from logged forests in the global south. So we are building international supply chains that destroy nature and harm animals beyond our borders. So we definitely need to have a global approach. And so that brings me back to what this One Health, the new One Health framing could enable, and this pandemic instrument. So the wording that we have seen that gives me hope is what the One Health High Level Action Panel says is that implementing One Health strategies is rooted in collaboration. We need to learn how to collaborate better, which means we need to break the silos. We can no longer treat health as a human health ministry kind of topic or department of health. We need to develop these strategies together with ministries that are responsible for animal welfare and animal health, responsible for agriculture, finance, all of these institutions need to come together and develop their plans together because their measures affect each other. So the Ministry of Health is great at ensuring that humans don't get antibiotics unless they are properly diagnosed. So good diagnosis to make sure that people receive as little antibiotics and only when they really need them. It doesn't help that the Ministry of Agriculture allows the use of antibiotics on animals without any control whatsoever. And through this new One Health definition, which also includes welfare, there is also wording on a whole of government, whole of society approach. There is wording on all these international institutions working together to develop a strategy. So there's now a theory of change within a One Health joint plan of action, which the quadripartite, so WHO, World Organization for Animal Health, the FAO, and UNEP developed together. It's a joint theory of, and it defines the key action tracks on how One Health can be enabled and how to tackle preventing zoonotic outbreaks, how to tackle antimicrobial resistance. So those kinds of strategies in which we break the silos and enable collaboration so that the strategies are holistic and effective could lead to a new way. The question is whether that intention is going to make its way into international strategies like the International Pandemic Treaty. So will the International Pandemic Treaty reflect One Health based on what this quadripartite, these four international institutions, are calling for? Or will it only stay within the human health, the WHO role and mandate? So they're realizing that they need to break the silos, but we are yet to see whether that realization gets reflected in the international efforts.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch because I do think, you know, on the one hand, we've said there needs to be a kind of decoupling from economics, you know, dictating everything, to more understanding and collaboration, you know, beyond economics. So it really is interesting. And for, you know, vets to not only be advocating on behalf of industry and how to make industry more profitable or efficient, vets should be advocating on behalf of animal health. And that's not actually one and the same thing, because if you're trying to make a system more profitable, as you've I think very expertly said throughout the interview, you might end up in a situation where you're making animals less healthy. So it really is important that these different bodies and these different interests are talking to one another, and that, and in a serious way, because as we've learned now with COVID, I think big health impacts are big economic impacts. They're big for the planet and everyone involved. So yeah. But it can sound a little huge, right? Like sometimes it sounds like it's so big. Are we just speaking about some like utopia? But at the very least, I think we're, you know, animals are being spoken about in these forums. I was a bit disheartened when I listened to the discussion that everyone was talking about One Health, but very few people were speaking about agriculture explicitly. And I think that some of the work you're doing at Four Paws with kind of speaking explicitly about agriculture, biodiversity loss, deforestation, like we have to actually name names and be explicit. So thank you so much for the work you're doing. Before we go to your quotes, I wanted to speak a little bit about so the how. In that report we spoke about earlier, we've got an understanding now of some of what the big problems are, some of the big drivers. And you guys provided some suggestions in that report on what you think could be done. We've mentioned one of them already, a kind of move towards a more plant-based diet. But there were others in there that I thought was quite interesting: tax credits, subsidies, focus on welfare. Could you maybe unpack some of those for us?
Of course. So there are measures that we can take on different levels. So on the national level, but also on the international level through the pandemic instrument. The pandemic has made us, so we've paid a very high price because of this pandemic in terms of lives lost, economic deficits. A lot of development efforts have been reversed. So we have lost so much through this pandemic that we have a bigger motivation now than ever to take big, bold steps. So we are not asking for utopia. We are living in a crisis. And this crisis builds a very strong case for bold action. So bold action would be, or would mean, that we need to phase out high-risk practices. We need to move away from factory farming. We need to move away from illegal wildlife trade. We need to move away from destructive systems like deforestation, biodiversity loss, because we want to grow and feed more farm animals. However, the measures that need to be taken to enable that need to be sustainable. Of course, here we could talk about financial incentives. So we need to see investments in positive practices rather than harmful ones. Here, this could happen on the national level, but also on the international level. We need to see a change in priorities. As I mentioned earlier, we need to move away from looking at endless growth and GDP as the one way of defining success. We need to move towards an economy of well-being where we ensure health not just of humans, but also of animals and the environment. And there are practical measures. What we also need to be aware of is a lot of the people who are linked to these high-risk practices are vulnerable communities. They don't have a lot of income. They are relying on these jobs for their lives and livelihoods, which means that if we expect a society to move away from wildlife markets or move away from factory farm systems, we need to support them in the transition. We need to help them develop alternative sources of livelihoods. And this is where we go back to this new One Health approach, where we talk about the whole of government and whole of society kind of strategy, where the stakeholders that are at the human-animal-environment interface are part of the solution. They are part of the conversation. They are given the chance to share their knowledge, but also learn about the risks and develop ways to transition away from these harmful practices and get financial support to transition away from these harmful practices. We're talking about a transformation, but we're talking about a very necessary transformation. We cannot afford to wait for another pandemic. We have lost far too much through COVID-19 to be okay with doing the absolute minimum. We cannot do the absolute minimum. This pandemic instrument cannot focus on the absolute minimum. This pandemic instrument cannot just focus on human health and the mandate of the WHO. We need a holistic approach where we develop the strategy together, also with the communities that need help to transition away from these harmful practices.
Yeah, something really interesting happens when you focus in on the specific communities, because you start to get a bit more in the specific interfaces. You know, you start to get a lot more specific with what the measures are you can take. So if you're talking about, let's say, slaughterhouse workers in North America, they were some of the most vulnerable communities when it came to COVID-19 because of where they're working. But you also realize that the whole system is structured around subsidies that the government gives to meat industries. And if you want to kind of create jobs for these folks and get them out of this interface, you need to be talking about government subsidies. So why are government subsidies going to supporting meat and dairy, but not necessarily legumes? You mentioned soy earlier, but 90% of soy is going to the meat industries. So where are communities rubbing up against wildlife? Where are people rubbing up against these sick agricultural animals? And what is bringing about these changes? And I think we've spoken about that throughout the episode today, deforestation, agriculture. And while we've spoken at kind of the national and global level that there's a need for new policy, there's a need for taking these interfaces seriously, for thinking about subsidies, I do think that there's space, though, as individuals and as smaller communities to do something. One Health doesn't have to be this big, lofty thing. You can think more in your own life about how One Health could manage. You could contact your own municipal governments. You can think about how recycling happens in your own spaces. You could move towards a plant-based diet in your own homes. Invest in cell agriculture or like there's so much exciting stuff happening where you could choose to be part of what this future is that you're talking of or hold on to what are really some troubling practices.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So on the individual level, we can change our behavior. We're also seeing interesting developments on the corporate level. It is now becoming more trendy for companies to be ethical. So we're seeing a rise in companies investing in plant-based alternatives. You know, in Austria, where I'm based, there is a branch of Burger King in one of the busiest subway stations that's completely plant-based. This is something that I wouldn't have imagined happening before the pandemic. So we have now a situation where we've seen so much suffering that we are seeing more bold actions. We're seeing companies only offering plant-based foods or setting goals to increase the range of plant-based products that they're offering. Even the biggest companies, for example, in Germany, there was a big company that only sold meat and is now almost completely plant-based. It's selling plant-based sausages and cold cuts, and they're expanding. So we are seeing developments not just on the political level or willingness on the national level, so on the individual level. We're also seeing a rise in companies that have recognized the need to move in a better direction. We're also seeing investors keen on investing in lower risk systems. So hopefully the suffering that was caused through the COVID-19 pandemic is enough of a trigger for more bold action.
Great. I hope so too. I hope that we can actually take seriously what other animals in the environment need. And I guess any sort of conceptual tool we have in our toolbox is a step in the right direction. And so we're nearing the end of the interview now, and I always give folks an opportunity to read a quote, about something that they're hoping to convey or someone who's inspired them. Do you have a quote ready?
Yes, I do have a quote. So for the animal welfare movement and experts from various disciplines, it has been clear for decades that we cannot view human health in isolation. Our health and well-being can be adversely affected by how we are treating animals and the environment. We cannot safeguard human health without improving animal welfare and protecting the environment. It is time to tackle the root causes of outbreaks and focus on prevention at source rather than cure. It is also time to expand the way that we define health and improve health policy in line with the One Health approach, because when animals and the environment suffer, we suffer as well. This is Four Paws. This is how we're communicating about the topic. So,
well, I think it really summarized what we spoke about today, which, I mean, we've spoken about so much. We've spoken about One Health, One Welfare, a variety of health concepts. I think I've got a lot going on in my brain. So thank you so much for your time today. Before I let you go, could you let us know a little bit about what you're working on now? And if folks are interested in learning more about you or the work being done at Four Paws, how can they do that?
Yes, thank you, Claudia. So what I'm working on right now with our international team and our national offices is influencing the international negotiations on the pandemic treaty. We are concerned that if the pandemic treaty only focuses on the stages after an outbreak, we would lose a historic opportunity. So we're engaging with governments, permanent missions to the UN in Geneva. We're working with experts from all over the world, different disciplines. We're engaging with the quadripartite, the four international institutions that are playing an important role in One Health. And what we're trying to make sure is that all these efforts on pandemic prevention are truly effective, and they can only be effective if we tackle the root causes of pandemics. So our day-to-day means talking to governments over video calls or setting up expert roundtables where we bring experts from the relevant disciplines to talk with governments on what should be in the international pandemic strategy. We're also working on the topic of AMR because it is not just very scary for humans and human health, but also tackling AMR would lead to massive improvements in animal welfare, and it would require a reduction in animal products. So our day-to-day for the moment is very much focused on influencing the international debate on pandemic prevention, improving animal welfare so that we can protect animals, but also humans. And if listeners and guests of the podcast are interested in learning more about our work, on the Four Paws website, you'd find information about our pandemics efforts, factory farming, live animal trade, fur farming. And there you'll hear or read actually a lot of information about our efforts on all the topics.
What countries is Four Paws in?
Four Paws is present in several countries all over the world. So our headquarter is in Vienna, Austria, but we have offices in Germany, Switzerland, the UK, Bulgaria, the US. We have a team in Ukraine as well, Thailand, Australia, South Africa, among others. So,
and you guys have been quite involved with helping to get animals out of the Ukraine, right? With the whole situation that's unfolding there.
Yes, we have been helping people with pets who needed to leave the Ukraine because of the war. We also have a sanctuary, a bear sanctuary in the Ukraine. So we have a team there taking care of wild animals in our sanctuary there, but also in sanctuaries all over the world as well.
Wow, that's also something that's kind of been haunting the edges of this season is, you know, we speak about biosecurity, but conflict is also actually a really important part of talking about health and about biosecurity too. I'll have to do a future season on conflict, I think.
Yes, definitely. So if people don't have access to clean water, for example, cholera is reemerging. It's quite a scary situation.
Definitely, we'll need to focus on that in future. Well, thank you so much for all the work you're doing with regards to pandemic prevention and at Four Paws. And for joining me today, I've really learned so much. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Claudia. It was great to speak to you today.
Hello, Mandy. Welcome back to the Animal Highlight.
Hi.
It's really good to have you back. I can't believe we're already on episode 9, which is pretty impressive.
I know. I don't know if it's like exciting or horrifying how quickly this has gone by.
I know. It's been a bit of a chaotic season. We were really running tight ship at the end of last year and then slowly started to realize that was a bit bonkers. So no, it's been a good season. It's been a really good season and so interesting. I've learned a lot actually about just, you know, biosecurity is one of those vague concepts that just sat somewhere in my mind. And I feel as though I'm really starting to grapple a bit more with what biosecurity is. And these highlights have been a great way of kind of just thinking about the dynamic ways in which animals are connected to health, security, disease. So really good. Who are we going to be focusing on today?
Yeah, today I'll be talking about pangolins. And I really, really appreciate how Nina Jamal offered important context regarding the framework of One Health today. And for this highlight, I want to continue thinking about One Health. And specifically, I want to discuss how this framework, while incredibly important and promising, can also run the risk of flattening out complexity and difference. So the theorist Nicole Shukin, who is the author of the book Animal Capital, that I cannot recommend highly enough, she offers a really brilliant critique, not of One Health per se, but of a really similar concept called the Global Village. And the global village refers to a unified, interconnected, and whole world with a shared vulnerability. And while rightly pointing to crucial interconnections, this concept, as Shukin notes, can also run the risk of, quote, smoothing over material differences and leveling all humans and animals within a shared state of vulnerability, end quote. And Shukin points out that in reality, humans and animals face differential vulnerabilities to disease or death along the lines of species, race, class, gender, nationality, etc. So as I focus on pangolins today, who are really implicated in the global biosecurity threats of wildlife trafficking and COVID-19, I want to also be mindful of complexity, and I want to be mindful of the ways in which different groups are differentially impacted by supposedly unifying threats. Now, pangolins have been described as the most heavily trafficked wild mammals globally. They're illegally hunted and traded largely because their flesh is considered a delicacy in several Southeast Asian countries, but also because their scales are used in traditional Chinese medicines. And some researchers have suggested that pangolins, due in large part to the disease-fostering conditions of illegal trafficking, may have been intermediary hosts in the transmission of COVID-19 from animals to humans, though later studies have shown that this is unlikely. but regardless of the actual role that pangolins have played in the evolution of COVID-19, them and East Asian people who consume them are among the main scapegoats for the global pandemic that we're experiencing right now. Now, this pilot highlight is about pangolins, but it's really important here not to gloss over how East Asian folks have been unfairly blamed for the pandemic, in part because of their relationship to pangolins. So neoliberal and orientalist pandemic discourses, in the words of Nicole Shukin, pathologize cultural differences, such as East Asians' perceived unhygienic intimacy with animals or exotic taste for animals, such as pangolins or bats. And for those who are just listening to the audio and not watching the video, unhygienic intimacy and exotic taste are in scare quotes here. And this has helped to fuel increasing hate crimes and discrimination against East Asian individuals and communities following the pandemic. Now, in regards to pangolins, it's not entirely clear how they've been impacted by COVID. On the one hand, bans on trading and eating wild animals following the emergence of COVID may have actually helped to give pangolins a bit of a reprieve. But according to A. Gosal and other researchers, there's also evidence to suggest that increased human confinement, the reduction in conservation enforcements, and the limited mobility of researchers may have all served to increase the likelihood of trafficking pangolins in certain locations post-pandemic. And it's also very possible that the association between pangolins and COVID has led to their increased persecution. So things are complicated. We now know, after this brief introduction, a little tiny bit more about how pangolins are enmeshed in biosecurity issues, and a bit more about the dynamic interplay between speciesism and racism. But who are pangolins? Well, they look a lot like armored anteaters, or maybe like four-legged pine cones with long tails, though in actuality, they're more closely related to the taxonomic order Carnivora, which includes animals like cats and dogs. And they have these overlapping scales, which are made of keratin, which is actually the protein that helps form human hair and skin and nails, and these scales protect most of their body. There's 8 species in total, ranging from vulnerable to extinction to critically endangered, and they live throughout the continents of Asia and Africa. There's really important differences among the different species and populations. So, for example, some are primarily ground dwellers, while others are primarily arboreal. However, they all live predominantly on a diet of ants and termites, and pangolins have some super cool characteristics to help them meet their unique dietary needs. So, as with many of the animals who I've already highlighted this season, pangolins have an incredible sense of smell, and this allows them to locate insect nests. They also have long, curved claws that are perfectly suited for digging, whether that's into mounds or tree trunks or rotting logs. And digging is such a fundamental part of their way of life that in Cantonese, their name actually translates to the animal that digs through the mountain. They have these really mind-blowingly long, dexterous, and sticky tongues that attach near their pelvis and that can be half the length or more of their head and body when fully extended. And they also have these special muscles in their mouths which prevent ants and termites from escaping after capture, as well as muscles that protect their eyes and nostrils from insects getting in. So essentially this makes them insect-eating machines. And it's actually estimated that one adult pangolin can consume more than 70 million insects annually. So just an astonishing number. But because pangolins, they're solitary, they're mostly nocturnal, and they're somewhat shy, much is really still not known about them. But pangolin rescuers and rehabbers share intimate relationships with individual pangolins, and they offer us really crucial insights into the unique personalities and life worlds of pangolins. So I want to close by sharing the story of Stevie, which is shared in a video by the Dodo that I will also share with you all on the Animal Turns YouTube channel. And Stevie was rescued from the illegal wildlife trade when he was only 3 or 4 months old, and he was brought to the Johannesburg Wildlife Vet to be cared for by an experienced wildlife rehabilitator. And upon his arrival, his really quirky and tenacious personality became immediately apparent. His carer refers to him as gassy, insistent, and strong, and they go on daily walks together to forage for termites. He actually rides on his human carer's back, just like he would have with his pangolin mum, and he digs into termite nests that they come across with so much zest and enthusiasm. At one point in the aforementioned Dodo video, only Stevie's little belly and hind legs are exposed, and his entire upper half of his body is totally engulfed in this termite nest, and he just seems to be having the time of his life. One particularly endearing thing about Stevie is his penchant for rocks. So he really loves to play with them, and his carer always makes sure that there's one in his overnight crate because of this.
I love that. Can't wait to watch that video of him playing with rocks in his way. This makes me think, you know, a couple of years ago, I tried to look it up now while you were chatting, but I think it was some men in Zimbabwe. So there were these caretakers of pangolins in Zimbabwe, and there was this incredible photo shoot to raise awareness about the plight of pangolins and these caretakers in Zimbabwe, and each caretaker had their own pangolin, and just these absolutely gorgeous images. And you don't realize that these little armored creatures are just, they're so cute, firstly. And then they're so, like, they've got these little mousy faces that are scaled. But yeah, there's just something really incredible about them. And they were, for a long time, I think, just no one knew anything about pangolins or thought about pangolins. And then they became really well known because of their status, I think, as these really trafficked animals. I like what you've done here because it makes me think a little bit about what I spoke to with Gladys in the previous episode about community-led conservation. You know, just how important the kind of local community interventions are in terms of the human-animal interactions that are happening, and that this can't be understood purely at a species level. You have to go to specific geographical locations, you know, what's causing or compelling people to engage in things like trafficking, to engage in things like poaching, if you want to really address these issues. You have to consider kind of these broader economic challenges and questions because, yeah, they're important. And yeah, thank you. Pangolins are just incredible. I can't wait to watch the video. Thank you for highlighting the YouTube channel. So there is a little playlist with all of the videos that Mandy's been finding up there. And yeah, pangolins. So the next one's the last highlight.
Yeah, so bittersweet.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mandy, for everything. And I hope you have an awesome day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Nina Jamal for being an incredible guest, to Gordon Clark for the bed music, Jeremy John for the logo, to Christian Mentz for his awesome editing work throughout the season, as well as to Amanda Bunton-Wahlberg for the great animal highlights. And a great season. Thank you so much to all of you. Also, thank you to you, dear listeners, for listening, for leaving reviews, for sharing the podcast, for including it in your syllabuses, for sending me emails and notes about what you enjoy with the podcasts and episodes. I really do appreciate those communications and that feedback. So thank you so much, so much, so much. Don't forget to join us in the next episode, which will be the final one for the season, where we do the grad review on biosecurity. I look forward to having you then. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hürtenfelder.
Hi.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.